WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I know how terrible it is that someone who's in the last 6 months of their life could be experiencing terrible pain.
A measure that would legalize medically assisted death for terminally ill patients is now closer to becoming a law in Illinois.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Stick around for a breakdown of the biggest local stories of the day later in the podcast. But now to a topic that brings out some of our deepest emotions. I'm talking love, loss, pain, and choice. And before we dig in, I do want to make sure that you're aware that we're going to be talking about death in this episode. Illinois could soon become the first Midwestern state to allow terminally ill patients the option to end their lives with medication prescribed by a doctor. Now, the bill was passed a couple of weeks ago, and now it's up to Governor Pritzker to decide whether it becomes law. Supporters say that this gives comfort and control to people dealing with unbearable suffering at the end of life. But disability rights advocates fear that it could create pressure on vulnerable people to end their lives too soon. We'll discuss now with some thoughtful voices on both sides of this difficult conversation. At the table was Kadeen Bennett, Director of Advocacy and Intergovernmental Affairs with the ACLU of Illinois, and Amber Smuck, who's Vice President of Advocacy for Access Living. I started with Kadeen, who's a longtime advocate in support of the bill, and it's now on the governor's desk. So I had to ask her, how does that feel?
I'm feeling really good about it. I know that the governor's office slipped in support of the bill. I know that this was a really important issue to the governor. One of his mentors, when he was going to pass away, he talked about the importance of this legislation. Lowell Jaffe, his name is in our bill as well. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm also really excited for people like Deb, who the bill is named after. Deb Robertson, she's somebody who is terminal. She has been an advocate using the remaining time that she has to advocate for this issue because she knows from personal experience, as somebody who wants to live, she's done every clinical trial possible because she really wants to live to see her kids, you know, continue to grow up, see grandkids. But she knows she's going to die. And with her particular kind of cancer, she knows it's going to be a pretty painful death. So it was really important for her to do this work, even though once the governor signs the bill, it's going to be 8 months until it goes into effect, mm-hmm. 9 months until it goes into effect. It was really important for me that she was able to see the result of the work that she was advocating for herself as somebody who's impacted by the issue and mm-hmm. being able to make that change for Illinois and other folks.
And besides Deb's story, which is the story of many people, why would you say the ACLU supports this legislation?
I mean, it's about bodily autonomy. We believe that people should be able to have decisions about what happens with their body, what kind of care that they have access to. This is care that is legal in 11 states and D.C., and we think it's really important for people in Illinois to have access to this care as well. It's also an equity issue. You know, Susie Flack, her son ended up, Andrew, going to California to access aid in dying there. And she talks about the luxury of being able to afford to go see him and have visits there. And not everyone has the ability, the resources to go to another state and get residency there or go for loved ones to see their family in some other state if that's where they're going. So it's really important for us to have this medical option here in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And it's a both and. It doesn't mean that folks aren't able to access palliative care, hospice care, other kinds of end-of-life care, but it's an option that people can choose if they want to. No one's forced to.
Amber, let's bring you in. Now, we have talked about this, you and I, last year. You were on Reset to discuss, and at the time you were opposed to having this become a reality. So remind us of why.
Okay. So this is Amber speaking, and thank you so much for having me on. I would like to remind people that there is a very distinct reality of suicidality among disabled people. Disabled folks face higher rates of suicidal ideation, higher rates of actually doing it, and then all of it has to do with the constant message that society feeds us about how people with disabilities are a burden, people with disabilities are less. And I want to point out that just within the last couple of weeks, I know a young person with a disability who tried to kill themselves. And it is precisely because of the message that you are not good enough, nobody wants to have a relationship with you, there will be no supports for you. And so the reality that people with disabilities live in is something that I think people who support this bill don't necessarily pay attention to. Folks will say, oh, this is about bodily autonomy, this is about choice. People with disabilities would like bodily autonomy. We would like choice. But that's not actually a real thing for us. And I want to point out that people who think this is really about choice, they are getting played. And the reason why I think people are getting played is because the original folks that made bodily autonomy a choice were eugenicists. And eugenicists were the ones that said, it actually would be okay if those who are not fit to live, if those who are a burden to society, could actually be convinced to off themselves. And so I think that people who use the choice argument for what we call assisted suicide, proponents call it medical aid in dying, I think that people need to understand that when you're using the choice argument, that it's very much a eugenic argument and that you are buying into that. And that's not okay for people with disabilities because we've always been targets of that.
I want to drill deeper into a couple of things that you brought up there, Amber. First, the language. Thank you for mentioning that differentiation, right? Because there's a difference in how even the two of you describe what we're discussing today, right? There's the language of medical aid in dying, right to die, as written in the legislation. And you use the word suicide several times, Amber. Talk to me about why there's a difference in terminology for you.
So there's a difference in terminology because there's a difference in terminology. We're talking about people ending their lives. We call it suicide. You're making a choice to end your life. There is research that shows that that's basically the definition of suicide. The Centers for Disease Control define suicide as that. So that's why we call it assisted suicide. And I also want to point out that this is very much a medicalized issue, right? But the problem for disabled people is that the medical profession is full of bias against people with disabilities. And I think I mentioned to you on the Reset last year that there was a study done at Harvard where more than 82% of doctors said that they actually think that people with disabilities have less quality of life. Now, that's relative. The doctors are not the ones living the disabled lives. People with disabilities will tell you that we actually have quality of life. And sometimes the people with the most severe disabilities are the ones that can have the best quality of life, given the support. And so for us, the choice eventually just comes down to, if you are going to say, oh, my God, people are suffering, well, why don't you end the suffering of disabled people by making sure that we have the care and supports that we need to live our lives?
Yeah. Let me hear from Kadeen on this, especially talk about the language for you.
I mean, I think we're talking about two different things. I think there is the issue of people who are living with disabilities, chronic conditions, that is one thing. This bill is about people who are terminal. They have 6 months or less to live. Mm-hmm. It's been confirmed by another doctor. And these are people who want to live, but they have a terminal illness. And we know both Andrew and Deb and other folks I've interacted with, they've tried all of these kinds of care to extend their lives, and they know that they're going to be at the end soon. I think, we don't call it assisted suicide because suicide is if you are going to live and you're choosing not to. I don't think we would say that somebody who chooses not to get chemotherapy is committing suicide. We won't say that somebody who is deciding that as part of their hospice care or palliative care, they've decided to get off any kind of machines. We don't call that suicide. These are people who are making a choice because they're terminal and they're making the choice of how they want to end their lives. It is not something that is an option for them. I'm sure that Deb would want to live for a very long time. And I think one of the issues I have with folks on the other side of this issue calling it assisted suicide is that it negates what people who are impacted by this issue, how they see it and how they talk about it.
What about Amber's points about it being harmful to disabled Illinoisans?
I mean, in one of our earlier conversations when we were talking about this bill, and I respect that Access Living has a different opinion here, I mean, I think we could all agree that we wouldn't want to see a bill that said medical aid in dying except for people living with disabilities. That is something that would be pretty problematic because we believe that people living with disabilities have the right and the ability to choose the kind of care that they want. One of the people who testified in committee, her name was Beth. She is somebody who is living with a disability. She's been living with a disability for almost all of her life, and she has talked about the importance of this legislation, that when it comes to making choices about how she lives and how she dies, she believes that all options should be available. So I think this idea that this, because of medical aid in dying, specifically for terminally ill people, that causes suicide for people living with disabilities, I don't think that that's a fair argument.
So you're saying as written, it's much more inclusive?
Oh, the bill is inclusive for everyone. Yeah. I was just saying that we would never want a bill that says, you know, this access to care for everybody except for people living
right.
with disabilities. So this idea that this is harmful to all people living with disabilities or all people generally, I don't think it's quite accurate. And it reflects the need of people who are terminal who have said that this is very important to them to have the option. We know that for some people, even just having access to the medication is enough for them. They don't necessarily need to take the medication. I think 1/3 of the people that we've seen in other states don't take the medication.
Right. I want to make sure that people don't miss that point, right? You know, folks do get the medication, but not everybody goes through with it.
Yep. And it's been very clear part of the protections we have in place outside of making sure that, you know, insurance companies can't dictate that somebody use medical aid in dying. That is prohibited. The Department of Insurance, they will be tasked with making sure that those, if an insurance company does that, there's disciplinary action there. At every single interaction with the healthcare provider, that healthcare provider has to talk about all options, including comfort care, palliative care, hospice care. At each point, they reaffirm that this person never has to take this medication.
Right.
At any time, even when you have the prescription, you could decide to never take it at all. And
right.
I think that's really important.
And that what you're mentioning, Kadeen, goes in line with what the sponsor of the bill, Illinois State Senator Linda Holmes of Aurora, says as well. She says there are more than 20 guardrails in place. And I'm looking at you, Amber, you're shaking your head. Tell me more about your concerns, particularly I want to understand better something that we talked about last year, right? You said a disabled person, as we talk about this 6 months to live, they could get a 6 month prognosis, but in a lot of cases it could be because of a bias and then they feel a pressure to ask for the medication. Walk us through that.
So there are a few pieces to what you just said. One is that six-month prognosis has been basically widely shown by research to be wildly inaccurate. You can't depend on a six-month diagnosis, and the entire bill is based on that, so that's kind of a problem. Second of all, I want to point out that legislation, just because there is legislation doesn't mean you will have protections. Because legislation can always be amended. The guardrails that Kadeen has been talking about, the penalties, first of all, in no state is there oversight to make sure that these particular kinds of processes have penalties. There's no oversight. Reporting relies on self-reporting. That's a problem. Nobody's going to come up to you and say, well, I guess I accidentally told somebody that maybe they should die. Nobody's going to come forward and say that. That would look like medical malpractice. So I want to say that legislation can always be amended. So the problem that Access Living has had with this bill is its introduction and its the passage of it in the first place, because what that does is set up a framework to be amended. People will say, oh, well, you know, we would never want to amend it. That would just be bad. And the fact of the matter is there are plenty of people out there who are saying, well, I really hope that lethal medication can be accessed for me if I get dementia or Parkinson's or some other kind of disability that just makes me really uncomfortable. I just would like to have that for peace of mind. That's not okay, because what that does is it tells us that amendments will come forward, and they have come forward in other states, to make it quicker, to make it easier, to make it more available to secure assisted suicide. And one thing that I want to point out, Proponents are very dismissive, I think, of disability concerns that this will lead to bigger consequences and widening of access to lethal medication to other populations. The reality is folks say, oh, well, that happened in Europe. Yes, it happens in Europe. But then you know what? It started happening in Canada. In Canada, it's just a five-hour drive away. It's getting closer, and it will come here. And now in Canada, you know, they are expanding it to people who basically have mental health issues and say, I want to die, so give me the medication. They fill out a form, like at the DMV, they get the medication, and now 5% of deaths in Canada are deaths through lethal medication. That is a problem.
So safe to say that these guardrails don't assure you.
They're not going to work. And they, the reason they're not going to work is because if you rely on self-reporting, it's going to be an issue. And we already have a rampant reality in the disability community where folks with disabilities are constantly facing doctors, insurance workers, you know, like medical professionals, you know, who take it upon themselves to interpret the law any way they want. We already face that. There is no guarantee that people are going to follow the rules or know how to handle somebody's suicide crisis in a responsible way. There is no guarantee.
Kadeen?
Yeah, a few things. One, depression alone does not make somebody qualified for this bill, nor does disability by itself. So those are some guardrails that are in place. I'd also say that, you know, in this process, we've worked with Access Living on litigation and advocacy generally. And from initial start, we've tried to have conversations where you can be opposed forever, but what can we do to make our language stronger? I've read everything that they've sent in terms of the concerns, drafted legislation to reflect some of the concerns that folks have had to have guardrails in place. And so I think the idea that, you know, this bill is not going to work, this law is not going to work because of what's happening in Canada or in Europe. We have other states to look at. This law has been in effect in Oregon since it was passed in 94, went into effect in 1997. There's no state that now has a law that says anybody can use aid in dying for any reason at all. It is still pretty narrow in terms of the scope.
How can, she brings up a point about coercion, right, in the disability community. How can coercion be prevented here?
So it would be a civil or criminal penalty if anyone coerces somebody to use this this tool, or if they prevent somebody from using this tool. That applies to doctors, that would apply to individuals. Doctors are able to have conversations with individuals for them to get a sense of, do you want this? Talk to me about why you want this. Those doctors are having conversations all the time about whether or not somebody is making an informed decision, whether or not it's their choice or not. There is a written request that a person would have to do, and in that request, there are two witnesses. One of those witnesses can't be somebody who has anything to gain from somebody using medical aid and dying. You know, in terms of coercion and care, there may be situations where somebody can be encouraged by a loved one. Please, you know, it's really expensive for us. I don't think you should go do chemo. I think, you know, you should, you know, just, you know, die, not avail yourself of care that's out there. Our law has so many, like, constantly talking to the doctor or provider. It has consequences for people who are going to coerce a loved one. I think this idea that this bill will be harmful to people living with disabilities. It hasn't played out in other states, but I also think that this law is for anyone who is terminal, people living with a disability and people who are not, to be able to take advantage of care that is legal in other states so that they can decide for themselves if this is the right tool for them.
Well, clearly you see it differently.
With all due respect, Sasha Ann, I'd like to respond to a few points. You know, I mean, with all due respect.
Sure.
So first of all, you know, what we see in other states, especially in Oregon, because people like to cite Oregon as the first state that introduced assisted suicide, and the fact that Oregon is supposed to be reporting all this data about, you know, the use of assisted suicide and so forth. One of the very interesting pieces of data from Oregon is that, as Kadeen mentioned, you know, this bill says, you know, people should be referred for mental health counseling, et cetera, deemed appropriate. In 2012 in Oregon, 33% of those requesting lethal medication were referred for mental health counseling. Today, less than 1% are. Mm. Why? Why is that? Is there somehow suddenly better mental health among people who are seeking lethal medication? What's this? So I want to say that time shows that the system degrades, and that's not okay. The other thing I want to say is just that, you know, again, we are at a political moment where we are facing, you know, attacks on Medicaid. People are going to lose health care. People are already facing screaming rises in their Affordable Care Act health plan. Mm-hmm. You know, we're facing a state budget situation next year where they want to make cuts. And, you know, what's interesting is home and community-based services and mental health services are very much at risk right now. And so there is a deep irony of instating this law to serve a tiny group of people that is actually going to require the building of a gigantic bureaucratic apparatus. So passing this means that, okay, maybe you're serving a few people, but you're going to have to build all of this extra stuff in order to try. You're not going to succeed, but to try to protect. And I think that when you say, yes, I want to have the choice for assisted suicide, first of all, you've been played because of the eugenicist argument. Second of all, you're saying, I want this for a few people, and the rest of them can go screw themselves. Hmm. That's what you're saying.
Well, clearly, different sides.
Can I just
I'm
say,
out of time,
I'm sorry,
unfortunately.
But for people like Deb, who are living with terminal illness, to say that it's just something for a few people, that really discounts the need for other people who are living with this terminal illness and what it means for them. So I think leaving people who are impacted at the core of what we're doing is really critical. Thank you.
We'll have to keep an eye and see where this legislation goes from here, as it's now on the governor's desk, as I mentioned. Thank you, ladies, for a spirited conversation. Kadeen Bennett with the ACLU of Illinois and Amber Smock with Access Living. We appreciate you. It's time to break down the biggest headlines and stories of the day. At the table was three journalists from the WBEZ newsroom, Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, city politics reporter Mariah Wolfel, and anchor reporter Alex Stegman. Claire kicked things off with an update on the Reverend Jesse Jackson's health.
So Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. was moved out of intensive care, out of the ICU yesterday as he continues treatment for a neurological disorder complication of his Parkinson's. He had been hospitalized last week to enable doctors to more, you know, closely monitor his conditions. Mm-hmm. At one point, he was on a breathing machine, but he was breathing on his own yesterday, and now he's out of the ICU. His family, you know, doing a lot of praying and saying, you know, that they're very thankful for the medical team at Northwestern Memorial.
Yeah.
So we will still be watching this and giving you day-by-day updates.
Mm-hmm.
Icon in Chicago.
Right. Minute by minute. I mean, I don't know about you, but I just keep watching just to see what's going on.
He's a strong person.
Yeah, we've got thoughts and prayers going out to that family for
Absolutely.
Sure. Absolutely. Alex, U.S. Senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin, got a lot of criticism. This was for his vote in ending that government shutdown that lasted what seemed like forever. But it looks like he's doubling down.
Yeah, and we expected him to. Dick Durbin, in case you need to be brought up to speed, was one of seven Democrats and one independent who got the Senate to the 60 votes it needed to pass the continuing resolution to fund the government up through January 30th.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that he's always done. Dick Durbin has never really wanted to vote to shut down the government. And he's always been somebody who, if there is an opportunity to end the shutdown, he's going to do it. He's done this before, and we're not really surprised that he did it now. And so it's not surprising that he would double down, saying
yeah.
that, you know, there are real people who are hurt by the fact that they're not getting paychecks.
Right.
And
what does he say Democrats won in this vote?
Well, it's not necessarily about Dems winning anything, but he says that they did get a concession that there is going to be a vote in mid-December.
Yeah.
And he was one of those Democrats. You probably heard a lot of the reporting earlier on that Democrats who agreed to this, they were able to take the Senate Majority Leader at his word that they're actually going to do this.
Right. Durbin's also weighing in on the Epstein files, isn't he, Alex?
Yes, he is. He, at an unrelated event yesterday, noticed that President Trump had done essentially an about-face on this, and he expects the House to vote on this week. today. They're getting ready to vote on it today. And he's not, and he didn't say when the Senate would take it up, but he expects that it should pass once they do.
Yeah. Mariah, let's bring you in here because we got to get an update on the city budget proposal. What can you share?
Yeah, so yesterday the Finance Committee voted 25-10 against the mayor's budget proposal.
Yikes.
And that is pretty rare, if not unprecedented, for such a wide margin and also for such an early vote. Johnson really pushed for this vote to happen yesterday, ironically, I think miscalculating that he had the support for his budget to pass. And then when he realized he didn't, his team tried to kind of delay this vote and schedule it till after the holidays. And that just didn't work. His allies tried to make that happen, but that motion failed by a tie vote. And then his budget, you know, his opponents were pretty impatient and they were waiting to vote on his budget so that they could vote it down.
Yeah, I mean, this really just shone a light on his already very strained relationship with the city council. This, I feel like, was just a new low, Mariah. So is the budget as is it just dead on arrival?
I think there's going to have to be some significant concessions, both between the council and the mayor. Obviously, the biggest sticking point has been this corporate head tax that the mayor wants to impose to raise $100 million a year that would largely go towards, you know, violence intervention, domestic violence funding, mental health supports for police, really creating a new line item in the budget that would be a regular revenue stream for violence reduction. Mm-hmm. And this would charge, as you know, we've talked about it before, companies of 100 employees or more, $21 per person a month. And so Johnson over the weekend was in this mad dash to try to get that proposal to be more favorable to some people. So he tried, you know, what if we do it at 200 plus employee companies? Mm-hmm. That didn't seem to work. And so then he dropped it back down to 100 plus, but then carved out, you know, small business grants as part of the revenue bucket, as one of the revenue buckets. And so, you know, yesterday Johnson made some pretty bold statements saying that, because he held a press conference after to kind of react to this vote, and he said, look, I'm going to veto any budget that has a property tax increase. I'm going to veto any budget that has a grocery tax, which many people see as a regressive tax. And I'm going to veto any budget that has a garbage collection fee in it, which have all been ideas that have been posed by alders who also say they want cuts in efficiencies. Johnson says there's no more cuts in efficiencies to be had unless we're looking at, you know, personnel within public safety departments. And by the way, I'll veto any budget that has cuts to the police department spending. And so he came out, doubled down yesterday, but, you know, it's all about actions speak louder than words, and we're really going to see in the next couple of weeks of what compromises he's willing to make.
Yeah, he said the corporate head tax is in this budget. It will stay in this budget. Is that clear enough? So, yeah, talk about doubling down. So that deadline is at the end of the year, Mariah, December 31st. What's next?
Well, there is a city council meeting today that Johnson was hoping was going to be the full vote on his budget. It looks like, you know, we'll see what happens if enough alders show up to formally, by the full council vote, reject his budget or vote on it and see what happens. But a lot of alders don't want to be, you know, casting their on-record votes for this at this moment.
Right.
They think it's just time to move forward and start negotiating, which, you know, they'll take a Thanksgiving break and probably come back. I mean, you know, for the next few days be talking and then take a Thanksgiving break and come back fresh in December to try to hash this out.
Claire, a woman critically injured. This was after being set on fire on the CTA last night. I mean, we've talked so much about safety on the CTA, Claire. This is just renewing those concerns.
Well, and what's odd is this, you know, arson is being investigated with this, which, speaking with Mariah, there was someone tried to set fire to City Hall. This was even on Friday. So just kind of a weird nether-related tie. But yes, a media reports a 26-year-old woman, this was last night around 9:25, riding a Blue Line train, had an altercation with someone aboard that train, began arguing with a man believed to be about 45. And then police say the confrontation escalated so much so that the man poured an unknown liquid on her, ignited it, and set her on fire. The woman sort of fell out of the train, collapsed on the platform. Flames were extinguished. I mean, this sounds like a movie, but it's actually, you know, she's in critical condition. So this is very serious. Officers arrived, put her out. physically.
My goodness.
Suffered severe burns. She was taken to Stroger in critical condition. No arrests have been made. Arson detectives, as we mentioned, still investigating. And CTA trains, they're still going.
Alex, you look like how I feel. Just perplexed.
That.
Shocked.
I don't think you could have written a movie like that. Just the amount of things that, wow, I seriously hope she's okay. That's
my
horrible.
Goodness.
That's horrible.
And Mariah, I don't want to ignore what Claire slipped in there. Someone tried to set fire to City Hall?
Yeah, so Johnson addressed this in his news conference yesterday, and there's very little information about what happened, but it happened around 11 p.m. on Friday night, and someone tried to set fire, you know, outside of the City Hall building, and luckily nothing, you know, took off, and it seemed like it, you know, went extinguished pretty quickly, but it did cause some damage to the building, but little information about what the motive was, and no one's been apprehended.
Mm-hmm. What else are you watching, Claire?
Well, the professor, unfortunately, is retiring. The professor, meaning Kyle Hendricks, crafty right-hander who helped the Chicago Cubs win the 2016 World Series.
Which professor is she talking about? My favorite professor from journalism school?
Well, he is a favorite professor of many baseball fans in Chicago. He was a legend over 11 seasons with the Cubs. He had one stint last season with Los Angeles. Had to just sign a quick $2.5 million one-year deal. But Cubs chairman Tom Ricketts calling Hendricks one of the best all-time Cubs pitchers.
Nice.
He got his nickname, the Professor, just so you know. He went to Dartmouth, and he sort of earned that name in college because he was using a different strategy. There was a lot of really hard-throwing pitchers, and he was more of a strategic guy.
Oh, okay.
An intellectual.
I thought he was
sorts.
Like a goody-two-shoes or something.
Did he invent sabermetrics?
I don't believe so.
All right.
Sorry. Didn't mean to throw anybody off there.
All right, Mariah. The Broadview mayor, she's declared a civil emergency in that suburb. What's going on?
Yeah, I think this was just after a lot of tension between protesters and the village, as well as some potentially unrelated, we're not sure, threats that Mayor Katrina Thompson has received. She received a death threat in October, and then the village hall received a bomb threat in September. Mm-hmm. And so those things coupled with, it seems like a pretty tense village hall meeting where protesters, you know, spoke their mind about how upset they were about Thompson's decision to limit protest hours, as well as, I think, take down an aid tent mm-hmm. near the processing facility, all kind of coupled to create what she felt as an untenable or unsafe situation for village trustees. And so she's signed this executive order, which I believe, you know, based on my read, the main tenet is that it allows them to hold all of their meetings virtual until, you know, the environment is deemed safe again.
I see. All right, Alex, Governor Pritzker has boosted his campaign coffers. What's happening?
Yeah, Governor Pritzker is typically self-funded. And this is the time of year when he typically self-funds his campaign. This year, he put in $25.5 million.
Just a chump change.
Yeah, just a little
no
something.
No big deal.
A little something, million here, million there.
Wow. How much has he typically invested in the past?
Well, a lot more than that. his first run in 2018, he was running against another billionaire, Bruce Rauner. So he had to pump a little bit more, $171 million in 2018. And then he also funneled $125 million into his campaign in 2022. And that was a year that he also tried to help a lot of Democrats up and down the ticket as Democrats tried to gain a bigger foothold in Springfield.
Mm-hmm. Because it's funny because I was joking about the chump change. But when you compare it to $125 million, and $171 million, I guess 25 isn't that much.
Well, and when you're talking about a net worth of $3.3 billion, I forget where his net worth is right now. But yeah, $25 million is kind of chump change.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, remind us when the Illinois primaries are, Alex.
They are March 17th.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. WBEZ's Alex Degman, Mariah Wolfel, and Claire Lane.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Linnea Dominic. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.
We'll be right back. I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.